Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the Martin White Memorial Lecture. I'm Christopher Hill, and I have my lecturer and Professor Andrew Linklater on my left. This, by my calculations, must be the 27th Martin White Memorial Lecture. It has become an important established part of the international relations calendar. I'm sure that most people in this room know all very well the importance of Martin White in international relations literature and especially theory. But for some perhaps new students at the school, let me say that Martin White was and has been recognized increasingly over the years as such one of the most important figures in the study and writing on international relations in this country and indeed worldwide. This lecture is held on a triangular basis between the London School of Economics, the University of Sussex, and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the three institutions which Martin White was closely associated with in terms of having been a researcher at Chatham House, having been a reader at LSE between 1949 and 61 in the International Relations Department, and then Professor of Modern History at the University of Sussex between 1961 and 72, to the point of his premature death. He was Dean of European Studies there as well, so sometimes the lectures which are held under this heading have a particularly European tinge to them. Martin White did not write so much during his lifetime, but he gave what by all accounts were scintillating and influential lectures which have been collected together since his death, as many of you will know in books like International Theory, The Three Traditions, with the help of colleagues like Brian Porter and Hedley Bull and of course Mrs. White and the White family. But his books, his other books, Power Politics and his collaborated work, Diplomatic Investigations, are classics in the field. Very glad to see that Mrs. White and the rest of the White family are here tonight. And we have as our lecturer this evening to inherit the illustrious mantle of the White lectureship, Professor Andrew Linklater. It's a particular pleasure for me to be able to host Andrew as the lecturer here because he and I arrived at LSE on more or less the same day, a very long time ago, in I think October 1973. We were both overlapping PhD students for a year. Michael Donlan, who's in the audience, was Andrew's supervisor. And we both worked with Geoffrey Goodwin on various matters. In my case, foreign policy. In Andrew's case, he edited, co-edited a book with Geoffrey Goodwin called New Dimensions in World Politics. After his work here as a PhD student, Andrew was lost to the UK community, although fortunately not to the international intellectual community. He went off to the University of Tasmania, and then after that he transferred to the University of Monash in Melbourne. And we eventually lured him back to the UK, to the University of Kiel. He's now Woodrow Wilson Professor of International Politics at the University of Wales at Aberystwyth, and he is, of course, known internationally as one of the leading international political theorists, very much in the same category, therefore, as Martin White, even if his own work is not exactly in the same tradition. But the one very notable thing about Andrew, I hope you won't mind my saying it, is that he doesn't fit into any obvious pigeonhole or category. He has had a long-term intellectual project, which is not evident in everyone in the academic world, which has been manifest in his three major books, Men and Citizens in International Relations, which came out of his PhD work here, Beyond Realism and Marxism, and The Transformation of Political Community. And he has in him, he's a theorist, but he is also interested in and sympathetic to empirical work. He's never got himself into a theoretical bunker. He's a person who combines elements of critical theory and has been sometimes said elements of the English school itself. So he's got a powerful eclectic strain running through him, and he's talking to us tonight on an intriguing title which I'm sure will range just as widely as his past work has done: The Problem of Harm in World Politics, Implications for the Sociology of State System. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed for your warm welcome, and let me thank my old friend Chris for his very generous opening remarks. It is, needless to say, a very great honour indeed to be invited to give the Martin White Memorial Lecture, and a great pleasure to give it here at the LSE. I had the very good fortune to read about 20 or 25 pages of Martin White's Systems of States about 2 years before its publication, while I was a PhD student here. Hedley Bull was then at the ANU in Canberra, and he was looking for a graduate student to check some of the references. And thanks to Geoffrey Goodwin, who held the Montagu Boston professorship, the chair that Chris now holds, it was this graduate student who spent a few intriguing days in the library at Senate House tracking down some of the obscure references in Systems of States. And that was how I first encountered the unrivaled vision of a sociology of state systems, which is contained in that work. As we approach the 25th anniversary of the publication of Systems of States, I want to pay tribute to Martin White's lasting contribution to the study of international politics by reflecting on his inspiring sociological vision. And my aim is to try to extend his argument a little from a cosmopolitan point of view, which draws on at least some theoretical developments in the discipline over the last 25 years or so. Proceeding in this way allows me to answer a distant call from John Vincent, yet another Montagu Boston professor, who suggested in the late 1980s that I write a chapter on cosmopolitanism for a book that John was planning on Martin White's theory of international relations. And tonight's lecture is a special pleasure because it allows me to complete important unfinished business at a time when interest in Martin White has never been higher. The most recent issue of International Affairs, I think, demonstrates this. And at a time of renewed creativity for the English school, thanks in large part to the initiative taken by Richard Little and Barry Buzan. I would just like at this point to pause and say how pleased I am to see Barry here tonight, others, some of whom I see have traveled from quite far. Michael Donnellan, my thesis supervisor all these years ago, and of course especially pleased to see Gabrielle White, Mary Boole, and Angela Vincent all here this evening. Having provided a brief explanation of the subtitle of tonight's lecture, let me say a few words about its title, The Problem of Harm in World Politics. Brutality has been the norm in world politics. Equality and reciprocity, to paraphrase Todorov, and seem to have been the exception rather than the rule. Harm, hurt, injury, unprecedented suffering in war brought the academic study of world politics into being 82 years ago, as we in Aberystwyth never fail to remind our visitors on open days. The question of what is to be done with the state's power to hurt, to use a phrase once used by Thomas Schelling, has dominated the study of world politics ever since. Central debates in the field have been concerned with whether harm in the shape of violence and coercion is an inescapable feature of state systems, whether harm could be eradicated if humanity could only agree on some basic moral principles, or whether all we can hope is that separate states will use diplomacy, international law and institutions to limit the suffering they cause each other. The English school has been at the centre of these disputes about how far states have made and can make progress in controlling the power to harm. Its members regard the society of states as crucially concerned with restraining violence. They value international order, knowing that its collapse will bring widespread suffering to peoples everywhere. But as Hedley Bull argued, the need for order can so easily come into conflict with the goal of justice, and international order may or may not promote world order, whose purpose is the well-being of individuals rather than the security of states. So in addition to asking how far states have made progress in maintaining international order, we can ask how far they have enlarged their common enterprise by striving to protect individuals everywhere from avoidable harm. The English school, and John Vincent in particular, has addressed this question, most notably, I think, in the study of human rights and humanitarian intervention. These cosmopolitan orientations are central to the approach to harm in world politics, which I want to outline tonight. What is most interesting from this point of view is how far different international systems thought harm to individuals is a moral problem for the world as a whole, a problem which all states, individually and collectively, should labour to solve. What is intriguing is how far different state systems developed what might be called cosmopolitan harm conventions. These are moral conventions designed to protect individuals everywhere from unnecessary suffering, irrespective of, amongst other things, their citizenship, their ethnicity, their class, or gender, sexual identity, or race. In world politics, unnecessary suffering or superfluous injury, expressions used in the Hague Conventions, usually result from state building, conquest, and war, from the globalization of economic and social relations, and from pernicious, racist, nationalist, and related doctrines. The function of a sociology of harm conventions is to ask how far different state systems drew on the idea of a universal community of humankind to create agreements that individuals should be protected from the harm such phenomena cause. Its purpose is to ask how far the historic state systems developed moral conventions which reveal that human sympathies need not be confined to co-nationals or fellow citizens alone, but can be expanded to include all members of the human race. Now, it may seem slightly odd to pay tribute to Martin White's sociological project in this overtly cosmopolitan manner. Martin White argued that cosmopolitan and other radical or revolutionist approaches are an important reminder that state systems contain very deep moral imperfections. But he seemed to doubt that cosmopolitan approaches and progressivist tendencies more generally will ever enjoy lasting success. As is well known, he did have a keen interest in what he called revolutionism, and at times he comes close, I would say, to Kant by stressing that we should value order because without it, efforts to promote justice are bound to fail. I want, therefore, to begin the lecture proper with some comments about Martin White's famous pessimism. Secondly, I will comment very briefly on how his writings on ancient Greece reflected his broader interest in whether or not the idea of a universal community of humankind has influenced the development of different state systems. Thirdly, some observations will follow on different forms of harm, which are important for a cosmopolitan approach to for the sociology of systems of states. And fourthly and finally, I turn to the question of whether the modern state system can be said to have progressed in making the unnecessary suffering of individuals a problem for humanity as a whole. Martin White described state systems as the loosest of all political organizations known to us, hence in part their fascination. The loosest because states have no superior, although each may acknowledge the independence of the others. Fascinating because the absence of a higher authority does not necessarily spell anarchy and chaos, but is perfectly compatible with order and society. He had in mind what he called the primary state systems of ancient Greece, China in the spring and autumn and warring states periods, and the modern European, now universal system of states, which was born in Italy during the Renaissance. Primary state systems fascinated White because there are so few examples in human history. He focused on the three examples just mentioned, adding that there may have been a fourth in ancient India. Barry Bazan and Richard Little have extended this list in their recent book, where they refer to city-state systems in what is now Pakistan, southern Mexico, and West Africa. A recent book on medieval frontier societies notes that an embryonic state system may have existed in Wales for much of the 12th and 13th centuries. This is the kind of thing one discovers by moving to Aberystwyth. No doubt this list could be extended much farther. Martin White's fascination with state systems owed something to the remarkable flair for self-destruction. Earlier state systems had ended in empire. None survived for more than a handful of centuries. He therefore asked whether certain laws or patterns have existed in all state systems, and suggested by way of a preliminary answer that three phases seem to recur. In the first phase, the number of independent powers declines sharply as small states are eliminated, the casualties of military expansion and war. In the second phase, increasingly violent competition between the surviving great powers dominates the system. And in the third phase, the final phase, we witness the end of the state system as one of the remaining predators achieves the goal for which it has been striving, that is to say, preponderant power and the ability to lay down the law. White did not, I think, advance the comforting thought that the modern state system will be the first to break the mold. His argument was that every state system ultimately rests on the balance of power, which is inherently unstable and which is eventually destroyed by the struggle for domination. Presumably, although I have to say I do not know this for sure, he thought that our own state system, reduced at the time he was writing to two superpowers weighed down with nuclear weapons, was moving inexorably towards its violent end. In all this, of course, we can see Martin White in his most fervently realist mode, the White who is remembered in the textbooks for maintaining that international politics is the realm of recurrence and repetition, the sphere in which progress just does not occur. We know from his lectures here at the LSE and all scholars owe Gabrielle White and Brian Porter an immense debt for their publication, but he was not persuaded by the cosmopolitan argument that the human race could or would ever come together in a universal community of humankind free from destructive sovereign states and poisonous nationalism. White added that cosmopolitanism is theoretically the least important form of radical thinking about world politics. He went on to say that no major work of international political theory had propounded this doctrine, although, he says, it has enjoyed some influence in practice. Cosmopolitans might choose to respond by arguing that the doctrine should be more influential than it has been in the past. It is, after all, they would say, I would say, the obvious remedy for so many of the world's ills. But White was, I think, quick to stress that cosmopolitan perspectives harbour their own peculiar dangers. And here I think it is important to remember his claim that the modern state system has known systemic war and international revolution in almost equal degree. Our system has been unusually susceptible to the horizontal divisions that result from conflicts between transnational ideological or religious movements over universal political goals, or from messianic struggles which threaten order, international order that is, by weakening respect for sovereignty and encouraging intervention. But pessimism is not the same as fatalism, and I want to stress once again his claim that order is not an end in itself, but potentially at any rate, a staging post to greater justice. Despite the long peace, as Gaddis and others call it, events may yet prove that White was correct in thinking that our own state system will be destroyed by violence, although analysts of the end of geopolitics and the obsolescence of force offer a more optimistic reading of future possibilities. We cannot know if progress in curbing violent impulses will last indefinitely, or if the modern state system will revert to type as the great powers rediscover their enthusiasm for imperial domination and their appetite for unlimited war. The literature that defends the idea of an extending peace raises the question implicitly of whether the modern system will reinforce existing constraints on the power to hurt, or the power to harm, and the human ability to extend compassion across national frontiers will come to have unusual success as a result. In this context, one might ask if Martin White focused too much on the dangers inherent in cosmopolitan doctrines, which hope for the withering away of the state and the dissolution of national sentiments, and too little on those cosmopolitan perspectives that complement, I think, his own rationalist perspective. Now, helpfully, the OED identifies two forms of cosmopolitanism. The first of them holds that provincial attachments should yield to the allegedly higher ethical conviction that our primary loyalties are to the whole of humanity. The second does not reject national ties per se, but opposes them when they ignore the legitimate interests of outsiders. The cosmophile, which the OED defines as someone who is, and I quote, friendly to the world in general, exemplifies this second approach. On this view, one should not defend or celebrate national affiliations and cultural differences when they burden outsiders with intolerable costs. On this view, cosmopolitans need to combine loyalties to co-nationals with moral obligations to the members of other societies, including the obligation to do no harm. This is roughly, very roughly, the position taken by Stoic philosophers such as Cicero. The observation that societies can agree on some basic universal moral rights and duties, however much they are divided on other scores, is one point where the Kantian and Grotian traditions of thought converge. Pointing to the harmony between them, Martin White argued that Kant and Grotius shared the belief that independent political communities have moral obligations to three constituencies: to fellow citizens, to the wider society of states, and to the still wider universal community of humankind. And raising one of the most important themes in the first chapter of Systems of States, White asks if parallels to these three constituencies existed in other state systems, in all state systems, and if powerful commitments to human equality worked their influence on the behaviour of states. The chapters on the ancient Greek city-state system and on relations between Greece and Persia explored the question of how far different states collaborated to reduce surplus harm, unnecessary suffering, superfluous injury. In those chapters, White argues that loyalties to the polis were far stronger than loyalties to Hellas and to the world at large. Ideas about the solidarity of the Hellenes and the unity of the human race clearly existed, but they were far too hesitant to check egotism in foreign policy. Some states made noble pledges not to destroy each other or to starve one another's peoples or endanger their precious water supplies in peacetime or in war. But oaths to avoid cruelty to outsiders were rarely effective. The modern ethical conviction that certain violent acts of state so shock the conscience of humankind as to invite or demand humanitarian intervention had, it seems, no counterpart in the ancient world. Nothing quite like the modern law of war or the universal culture of human rights existed. The Greeks' apparent disgust at human sacrifice and their alleged intervention in Carthage to bring an end to child sacrifice were the exception. Their horror at the Carthaginians' annoying habit of drowning sailors who drifted nearby was in White's view, evidence that the Greeks had some respect for human life outside the state of war. But there were no ingrained habits of creating cosmopolitan conventions to protect all Greeks or individuals everywhere from unnecessary suffering. Well, while White may not have been persuaded by the argument for any cosmopolitan ethic, he was clearly intrigued by the sociological matter of how far visions of the community of humankind have shaped the evolution of different state systems. At no point did he argue that all state systems can be measured by some common ethical yardstick. Indeed, a kind of morality assessment exercise, loosely modeled in the research assessment exercise, may have been anathema to him. I do not know. I cannot tell. But even so, some of the foundations for a cosmopolitan approach to the sociology of state systems can be found in his specific comments about cruelty in ancient Greece and elsewhere throughout his rationalist position. Let me now deal more directly with the problem of harm in world politics. As I have said, it's hardly surprising that an interest in harm has long dominated the discipline. Many or most states and empires in history have been in the business of warring with, conquering, enslaving, injuring, and otherwise disadvantaging the members of other societies. Perhaps the will to harm has been the dominant pattern in world politics since the appearance of the Sumerian city-state system and since the establishment of the first empires. On this point, this theorist must defer to the historian. Scattered references to harm and injury are plentiful in the academic literature. I have a growing collection of them. But there is no distinguished body of work, no great tradition, no emergent subfield of inquiry which examines how harm to individuals has been understood, managed, and controlled in different state systems. And this, I think, is something to remedy. The English school has said more than most approaches about the problem of harm in world politics. Its members have been fascinated by societies of states because these are made from conventions that place moral and legal constraints on the power to harm or the right to hurt. And as noted earlier, the question of whether it is possible to extend cooperation to prevent harm, for example, by strengthening the human rights culture or by creating new principles of humanitarian intervention, has long been special to the English school. The approach I'm outlining here tonight tries to take this farther by starting with the assumption that the universalization of the harm principle, that is to say, the global extension of the principle that obliges us to avoid harming others unnecessarily, is a crucial part of a world ethic. The harm principle is only one part of that ethic, and it would be a grave mistake to claim too much for it. Other vital ingredients include altruism, benevolence, and charity. But that said, there are at least two reasons why the harm principle is a central part of a global ethic and a core element of a sociology of state systems with a cosmopolitan intent. There is in the first place the need to deal with what the moral philosopher Geoffrey Warnock once called the damaging effects of limited sympathies. Warnock's point was that loyalties to particular groups often lead members to be cruel to outsiders or to adopt a stance of complete indifference to ways in which one's own group damages the interests of outsiders, whether by accident or design. He added that many basic moral conventions in domestic societies are designed to protect the vulnerable from the negative consequences of limited sympathies. This is just as true of international society, of course, where loyalties to particular sovereign states have their familiar dangerous effect. There are parallels here with the notion of the cosmophile, in that it is the harsh consequences of limited sympathies and not the existence of bounded loyalties that a global ethic needs to address. A second and related point is that such limited sympathies are tied up with the fact that human collectivities do not have the same conception of the good society or the good life. This, of course, is a central theme in the English school, and particularly in Hedley Boole's claim that societies of states are only possible because independent political communities recognize, despite their radically different conceptions of the good, the attractions of mutual forbearance, including, of course, the need to maintain constraints on force. Rousseau maintained somewhere that a state can die without any of its members being injured. Perhaps, but since the rise of modern nationalism, it has been impossible to distinguish harm to the state from harm to its individual citizens. And as E.H. Carr argued, struggles to make states correspond with nations, struggles that led to the displacement of minorities and encouraged total war, made it imperative that the society of states evolve new principles to protect individuals in and of themselves. Because of nationalism or pernicious nationalism, it has become even more important to judge international order by the extent to which it promotes world order as defined by Hedley Boole. And bearing all this in mind, we can explore the development of cosmopolitan harm conventions in modern world politics, and we can ask how the modern state system compares with state systems in the past. Analyzing the dominant cosmopolitan conventions in different state systems is, I think, one way of building on White's sociological imagination, one way of exploring farther the regions where the Grotian and Kantian traditions intersect, one way of making the Kantian ideal of a cosmopolitan condition of general political security more central to the English school than it has been in the past. To develop this farther, it is useful, I think, to identify different forms of harm, different ways of causing distress, suffering, apprehension, anxiety, or fear, different ways of damaging vital interests. And I want now to distinguish five types of harm, five different reasons why international society needs stronger cosmopolitan harm conventions. In what follows, these different types of harm will be treated more or less as if they lead separate lives, but the events of September the 11th and the war against Afghanistan have more than any other event I can think of in recent times demonstrated their close interdependence. My first example is deliberate harm in relations between independent political communities. The most obvious example is war. Now, as noted earlier, Martin White believed that all state systems have enjoyed at least temporary success in limiting the use of military force. But no state system has succeeded, or seems likely to succeed, he thought, in bringing violence to an end. White was drawn to analyzing institutions such as the balance of power, diplomacy, and international law, which preserve order in world politics. A cosmopolitan variation on his approach can focus on past and current efforts to prevent unnecessary suffering in war, raising along the way the question of what constraints militaries have observed and what risks they have been prepared to run to prevent unnecessary suffering to others. It is important, I think, to know more about how far different state systems have attempted to protect individuals from unnecessary suffering caused by the first form of harm. More about rules concerning the status of women in war, civilians more generally, and of course, prisoners of war. The desire to spare individual suffering in war has been the main reason for the development of harm conventions in world history. But serious human rights violations in the modern world have led to the conclusion that it's just as important to protect individuals from their own government. And therefore, my second example of harm is the harm that governments inflict on some of their own citizens by waging war against them. Now, as noted earlier, members of the English school have long been interested in sovereignty, human rights, and intervention. In recent times, and especially since the implosion of the former Yugoslavia, sharp differences have emerged between those who believe that humanitarian intervention erodes support for national sovereignty, so weakening one of the central constraints on the great powers, and those who believe the current international order can bear the burden of experiments in humanitarian intervention, and indeed must do so if conventions on genocide and declarations of human rights mean anything at all. Wherever these debates may lead, the modern state system seems unusual and may even be unique in creating legal and moral conventions that so erode the sphere of domestic jurisdiction. Here, at any rate, is a second reason for creating cosmopolitan harm conventions. Deliberate harm by non-state actors is my third form of harm. I have in mind harm caused by pirates, mercenary armies, by contemporary transnational criminal organizations involved in the traffic of women and in the international drugs trade, by transnational corporations, of course, by international terrorist movements. Cross-border or transnational harm caused by such actors is a third reason for designing harm conventions with universal scope. Thus far, my emphasis has been on deliberate and coercive harm, but some forms of harm do not have this configuration. Addressing what we now know as globalization, Marx noted how new technological developments in Britain could destroy entire livelihoods in China in a single year. The actors at the source of this long-distance harm were not always aware of how their actions affected foreigners, and it would have been futile to criticize them for intending to cause harm. Marx's insight, the importance of Marx's insight, was that the growth of the world market exposed an increasing proportion of the human race to unintended long-distance harm. A double revolution in world history was taking place. Old types of deliberate harm caused by warring states and expanding empires were being replaced, Marx thought, by diffuse forms of harm transmitted across frontiers by global capitalist forces. An extended sense of moral responsibility, of course, Marx thought was necessary and would emerge with the advent of global socialism. Whatever one thinks of Marx as a forecaster and whatever one thinks of his utopian vision, he was surely right to stress the growing importance of unintended harm or long-distance harm, and correct to defend, although Marx does more than this, the need for universal conventions which protect the vulnerable from global market forces. In our own time, the increase in what Ulrich Beck has called the imperceptible harms which are inherent in the global risk society underline the importance of Marx's point. Environmental degradation is the best contemporary example of how the repetition of everyday actions which are harmless in themselves can, with the passing of the generations, create outcomes that no one actively desired. Many approaches to global governance and environmental ethics and many international legal conventions respond to this phenomenon by arguing for new responsibilities for avoiding harm. There is a fourth reason for developing cosmopolitan harm conventions. With some exceptions, the English school has not been that concerned with this fourth form of harm. However, in his study of human rights, John Vincent highlighted specific ethical issues which are raised by harm which is not intentionally exported from one society to another, but transmitted across frontiers haphazardly by global forces. Many of you will remember his argument that every human being has an equal right to be free from starvation. His central contention was that the affluent have a moral duty to show compassion, but he added that their awareness of how they benefited from global structures which bring terrible hardship to others should strengthen their moral resolve to end starvation and reduce global inequalities. John Vincent identified an orientation to global moral responsibilities which has grown in importance in recent years as individuals reflect on what Ted Honderich has called the wrong we do in their ordinary lives. Whether the focus is on child labour, on sweatshops in the fashion industry, on fair trading, on socially responsible investment or ethical tourism, there is evidence, some evidence, of a growing concern with the problems that our associations with various institutions create for our moral lives. The point is that such institutions may cause harm that individuals would not do in their own right. The core moral issue here is complicity in the misery of others, complicity in the sense of benefiting from the exploitation or suffering of others. A further reason for developing cosmopolitan harm conventions is provided then by the structures that bind the affluent and the vulnerable together. And one important ethical question which arises in this context, but one I will not deal with here tonight, is whether causing harm is always morally worse than benefiting from the harm that befalls others and doing nothing about it. My list concludes with a fifth form of harm. This is negligence, the failure to take reasonable precautions to prevent the risk of harm to outsiders. Two examples are nuclear colonialism, testing nuclear weapons in the South Pacific with seeming indifference to the health of local populations, and environmental apartheid, as it's been called, the practice of exporting hazardous waste, for example, to societies where safeguards are lower than in the West. In each case, we are dealing with moral indifference rather than with cruelty, although interestingly, the OED does not care for the distinction. The crucial point is that the negligent knowingly export risks and hazards which are unacceptable in their own lives. Here then is a further reason for weaving cosmopolitan harm conventions into the structure of international society. The current war against terrorism has at one point or another brought all of these forms of harm into focus, but my main interest is to use the taxonomy to carve out some basic questions that a cosmopolitan approach to state systems should strive to answer. Here are some examples. We can ask if state systems developed moral conventions with the aim of preventing unnecessary suffering in war. We can ask if they developed moral conventions which declared that the harm governments do to their own citizens is a moral problem for the world as a whole. We can ask if all state systems developed conventions which offered peoples everywhere protection from private international violence, from the effects of long-distance harm, from unintended harm, from exploitation, from complicity, from negligence. Admittedly, it is difficult to compare how different state systems have responded to long-distance harm because earlier systems did not experience the level of global interconnectedness that now exists. However, the virtually universal phenomenon of slavery raises questions about how far guilt, about benefiting unfairly from the suffering of the others, or concerns about complicity in the suffering of others, have appeared in all state systems. And with such questions in mind, I suggest we can build on Martin White's discussion of how far visions of a universal community of humankind influenced the evolution of the major state systems. So, a cosmopolitan approach is less concerned with uncovering laws or tendencies which may have appeared in all state systems than with understanding what different state systems have accomplished in preventing avoidable harm. It is hard, at least for me, not to ask if any state system outruns all others. Now, perhaps the temptation to ask this question is one temptation to resist. Whose conception of cruelty or unnecessary suffering should inform the sociological? Where is the Archimedean viewpoint that allows meaningful trans-historical comparisons to be made? Perhaps the sensible task is to try to decide whether or not the modern state system, or the most recent phase of it, represents an advance beyond its bloodier past. Now, interestingly, Martin White argued there may be more to question than to support, but the idea of progress was a factor in the study of state systems in which he, along with Herbert Butterfield, Adam Watson and others, were involved. The assumption that state systems are better than other forms of world organization underlies, White wrote, the choice of state systems as a subject of study. Robert Jackson goes farther by arguing that the society of states is the best form of world political organization yet devised for promoting peaceful coexistence between separate communities. Very important issues arise here which deserve further investigation. A useful place to start, perhaps, is with three perspectives on whether the idea of progress should or should not be built into a sociology of harm conventions. The first of these approaches is the progressivist interpretation of world politics, an approach that Martin White, of course, famously rejected. This is the view that steady progress has occurred in world history, not only in recent decades, but more profoundly, over the course of the whole human past. Studies of the unique liberal democratic peace and the growth of the universal culture of human rights offer the best contemporary academic defense of this approach. For its part, the English school is usually thought to be at odds, seriously at odds, with progressivism, although I suggest that Hedley Boole and Adam Watson defended a progressivism of sorts when discussing advances in the 19th century in abolishing the slave trade and slavery and in developing the humanitarian law of war. In the influential Hagee lectures, Hedley Boole referred to progress in human rights and in applying the welfare principle to international society. John Vincent and Nick Wheeler see some progress in the area of human rights. But such progressivism is surrounded by major reservations. It comes with an emphasis on the precarious nature of international order and on the fact that harm conventions are controversial both in their design and in their application. In Martin White's comments on Kant in his LSE lectures, we find some reasons for treating the idea of the liberal peace with great care. He points to the dangers of thinking that all societies should be committed to the same principles of government. To apply this to the liberal peace, there is the danger it may be grounded in a belief in the superiority of the liberal world to the non-liberal world, in disinterest in the suffering of non-liberal peoples, and in the belief that the principles that apply in the liberal world between liberal states do not apply in wars with illiberal societies. But that is not necessarily to say that progress is nowhere to be found, for example, in the area of human rights. The anti-progressivist standpoint, my second standpoint, denies there has been progress in history or anything other than short-lived digressions from more persistent trends. In the somber conclusion to Mankind and Mother Earth, Arnold Toynbee states there has been no progress in human history outside the technological sphere. And on this view, there are clearly no grounds for thinking that the modern state system supersedes earlier state systems in its desire to reduce human suffering. Liberals will protest, perhaps, that the Assyrians, the Romans, the Mayan, the Aztec, and the other Amerindian civilizations differed from the modern state system by specializing in physical cruelty. Certainly, ancient Romans seem to derive unusual pleasure from what's been called the public spectacles of death, in which enemies, traitors, and exotic animal species were slaughtered in staggering numbers. Norbert Elias may have been right to analyze the civilizing process in which aggressive impulses have been tamed, and the pleasure derived from cruelty, if not the level of cruelty itself, has been suppressed in the modern world. Others, Michel Foucault most famously, suggest the picture is more complicated since modern societies create new forms of power which are less manifestly cruel and less public than their predecessors, but hard or impossible to reconcile with the idea of human progress. Others, Bauman, for example, link modernity with new forms of social interdependence and new opportunities for mechanized violence in which large numbers of individuals can take part in genocide without having to face the human consequences of their actions. This anti-progressivist standpoint can be underscored in other ways. Progress in defending human rights and in promoting the law of war has to be viewed against the background of human rights violations and civilian casualties in war, which have few historical parallels. Progress in the struggle against racism has to be placed, too, in the appropriate historical context. Ancient Greeks and Romans, so I am told, do not seem to have been wedded to the later European idea that racial differences have deep moral significance. Progress in curbing violent impulses, if that's what it is, takes place at the very moment when economic globalization determines the fate of an increasing percentage of the world's population. Some forms of coercion are deemed to contravene international law, while various forms of economic harm are regarded as just how it is with markets. None of this supports the claim that the modern state system has made much progress beyond earlier state systems in tackling human suffering. Elements of the progressivist and anti-progressivist standpoints can be combined, I think, in a third approach, which focuses on standards of legitimacy in world politics. And here, I think, the central question is whether modern states are judged by higher moral standards than states in the past. Standards of legitimacy are evident first in rules about how decisions should be made, in understandings about what counts as a fair procedure. But they are evident also, secondly, in the actual decisions that states reach about what is permissible in statecraft and what needs to be proscribed. The English school has been especially interested in how the standards of legitimacy, which decide rights of representation in world politics, have changed over the centuries. Evan Luard argued that in the ancient Chinese state system, dynastic rulers made foreign policy by and for themselves. So did the absolutist states of early modern Europe. My colleague Ian Clark has argued that new standards of legitimacy enlarge the boundaries of the global decision-making community at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, concert of the great powers, institutionalized consultation about matters of common concern. Carrying the story forward, one might add how support for the idea of national self-determination gave the smaller nations the right to be heard in the global dialogue at the end of the First World War. The anti-colonial revolution, and to a lesser extent, the revolt of the indigenous peoples, have also transformed past assumptions about who has rights to be represented in global decisions. Many non-governmental associations and social movements that resist globalization are trying to take this process further, as does the vision of cosmopolitan democracy developed by Daniele Acabucci and your very own David Held. All of these developments are relevant to the question of how the international order has changed and could be changed more radically so the weak can protest against actual or potential forms of harm. Such developments and demands would appear to be unique in the history of international relations. They seem to confirm Barry Buzan and Richard Little's judgment that the idea of equality had little causal importance in earlier state systems. They suggest that no analysis of the modern state system will be complete if it fails to note how the idea of human equality has influenced its principles of legitimacy. Not only its principles concerning how decisions should be made, but what emanates from those decisions, from those processes. Concrete decisions about what is permissible and what is proscribed in world politics. It is no longer extraordinary, at least in our own enlightened circles, to argue that decisions should have the consent of everyone who may be harmed by them. Although the realist expressing the anti-progressivist viewpoint I mentioned earlier will be quick to stress the gulf between principle and practice. There is no point denying that. But it is important to stress that modern standards of legitimacy, as embedded in international law, declare that individuals have the right to be spared what is usually called serious mental or bodily harm. This would seem to be a new development in the history of state systems. The crucial question then is whether the modern state system has progressed beyond its predecessors, not only in the way in which decisions are made, but in universalizing the principle that individuals should not cause unnecessary harm. We might start to answer this question by noting how physical cruelty has come to be regarded as a moral problem for the world as a whole over roughly the past century. This is evident in different areas. In fundamental changes in thinking about what is permitted and what is forbidden in war, as exemplified by the assault on sovereign immunity introduced by the Nuremberg Charter and restated by the resolutions that established the international criminal tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. Along with the UN Security Council, resolutions which include rape in war in the list of crimes against humanity, such developments embed the principle of human equality in international society. They enlarge the domain of cosmopolitan or world law. And to focus on a matter of great contemporary importance, we might cite evidence here of seemingly reduced, public tolerance for the direct targeting of civilians in war. New standards of legitimacy regarding physical cruelty do not simply focus on violence in relations between states, but include the violence that governments choose to inflict on their own citizens. This is a second example of how physical cruelty has become a global moral problem. Several international legal documents, the Conventions on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, on genocide, on torture, as well as the UN Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women, outlaw again serious bodily or mental harm. Outlawing harm to the members of different national, ethnic, racial or religious groups is a recurrent theme in these conventions. In this manner, significant progress has occurred in realizing Kant's claim that the violation of human rights anywhere should be felt everywhere. Significant progress has taken place in contracting the sphere of domestic jurisdiction. The question is whether any other state system went down this particular route. Changes in the areas just mentioned suggest at least some progress has occurred in expanding the geographical scope of moral concern. That is, there has been some movement in expanding the circle of those with rights to be free from unnecessary suffering. Of course, that's only part of the story. Critics of NATO's military action against Serbia highlighted the selective enforcement of international law. One might wonder how far the new principles of legitimacy have made a difference to the women and children of Iraq, or will make any difference to those gripped by famine in Afghanistan. But for what it is worth, the tension between principle and practice in the modern world does not escape close scrutiny. And contemporary standards of legitimacy provide resources with which states, NGOs, and other actors, resources which they can use in the struggle against unnecessary suffering. From this resistance, or from these contradictions, more ambitious experiments in globalizing the harm principle may yet grow. But others, of course, may prefer Martin White's pessimism. They may wish to defend pessimism in the following way. Maybe we can point to advances in developing an ethic which puts cruelty first. This is partial progress along one axis. But there is a second axis which is concerned with the depth rather than with the scope of moral concern, with the vertical rather than with the horizontal dimensions of global morality. The importance of depth has been highlighted by those who criticize Western conceptions of human rights for stressing liberal and political as opposed to economic or social rights. The point is made that more radical harm conventions are needed to address conditions of unspeakable squalor and extreme vulnerability to global market forces. The recurrent theme here is that the dominant harm conventions will continue to lack legitimacy in the eyes of much of the world's population unless they address questions of depth as well as scope. We have heard much about this in recent times. Other state systems did not face such a tangled web of moral issues to the same degree or at all, and that places limits on meaningful historical comparisons. But some judgments can be made within narrower horizons. The modern state system seems unique in having to address the multiple forms of harm described earlier. It does not lack the moral resources with which to increase the depth as well as the scope of moral concern, but whether it will use these resources to tackle forms of harm caused by capitalist forms of production and exchange, as well as by state building and war, and by various doctrines of cultural, racial, and religious supremacy remains unclear. Recent events are hardly encouraging, but not the last word. The main issues are how far the modern state system and its dominant economic and political interests will need to draw on cosmopolitan sentiments to ensure legitimacy, and how far actors with a reformist orientation can persuade the more powerful of the need for more radical harm conventions. It is not hard to approach these issues without accepting some of Martin White's pessimism, but important to connect it with support for the requisite global ethic. To talk for longer would be to cause unnecessary harm. So to conclude, this lecture has relied heavily on two of Martin White's insights. The first is that the sociology of state systems is a vital area of scholarly inquiry. We should know more about other state systems. We should know more about how our state system looks in comparison with them. The second insight is that we can usefully analyze the extent to which ideas about the universal community of humankind influence the evolution of different states' systems. My task this evening has been to develop these themes in a sociological project which focuses on the problem of harm in world politics. In taking this course, I've been influenced by White's concerns, White's comments rather, about how the Grotian and Kantian traditions overlap in important respects, and influenced too by his important observation that international order is important because justice will not develop without it. Bringing Immanuel Kant into the discussion is not to set revolutionism against White's realism. Because the struggle for power will not come to an end, because tensions between principle and practice are not going to disappear, the central question is how far the exercise of power can proceed with the minimum of domination, with less cruelty, with lower forms of negligence or indifference. It is how far it can operate with maximum accountability to others, and especially to the most vulnerable members of world society. These moral matters enjoy a certain permanence in human affairs and a heightened importance at the present time. This is why the problem of harm in world politics deserves pride of place in a cosmopolitan approach to the sociology of state systems. Thank you.
Is it working?
Yeah.
I'm interested.
Can't hear you on the top.
I'm interested in pursuing the question about legitimacy and what you were saying about harm. In that, I think an interesting point to push on this is the connection between harm and what the definitions of that could be in terms of the link between harm and, say, legitimate harm and illegitimate harm in terms of punishment. I mean, we can all agree that things like cruelty and stuff are not good, but in pursuing international relations, there's always this question of the legitimate use of violence and what is legitimate, what's not legitimate, and then the relationship between law and, say, punishment, where punishment is required to create order and so on and so forth, where that kind of harm and that kind of violence is legitimate, and the use of war is legitimate in a way to create order in the English school, for example. Or even in a rationalist concession, where if you're not participating in an understanding of what order is, it's a matter of will and not a matter of reason, and therefore punishment is necessary to maintain order. And you see that in Locke, especially in his discussions of like slavery, where people forfeit their rights through will. And I'm just wondering if maybe the discussion about harm needs to address the question of punishment and the use of violence in the international.
Well, I'm first of all, can you hear me if I stand out here? I want to maintain the distinction between legitimate and illegitimate harm. I'm reserving a category for acts which are legitimate acts of violence, legitimate forms of harm. And in that context, I would agree with you that there is a role for punitive action in world politics, legitimate harm in world politics. The issue is, for me, what forms of suffering to individuals are permitted or are prescribed in the course of punishing others. So the relationship is a triangular one. It's harm, the general discussion of harm, legitimacy, and the suffering of individuals. So the kind of emphasis that I'm trying to draw out, I think, is meant to be a way of fathering certain tendencies in the English school, which I think have been concerned, not exclusively, but of course maybe largely, with relations between states. I want to shift the emphasis more to individuals and non-state associations, such as minority nations or indigenous.
This question, I think, follows on from the previous question. If one wants to move from a sociology of harm to a political theory of harm, one needs to offer criteria to determine what harm counts as necessary and what harm counts as unnecessary. Marx felt that the harm caused by the spread of capitalism was, in a sense, necessary harm. The English school, in its more conservative guise, has argued that intervention in order to uphold the balance of power is necessary harm. And I wonder, in thinking about criteria, whether ultimately one doesn't need a theory of history in order to determine what, at the end of the day, is to count as necessary and unnecessary. Because if we don't have at least a strongly implicit view of where history is coming from, where it is going, and what's driving it, I wonder whether one can offer clear criteria as to what is to count as necessary.
Thank you. Pick up the first point you made, Peter, on moving from a sociology to a political theory. In fact, I'm kind of moving the other way. I'm moving from a general kind of ethical position on harm and dialogue to a sociology, to an historical sociology. But in so doing that, I want to assure myself, I suppose, this is perhaps about my own ontological security, I want to kind of assure myself that the notion of do no harm is an important part of a global ethic. So part of my sociology does have that moral philosophical dimension to it. But only to ground the sociology in some ethical foundations. I want to mix my drinks, facts and values, as we positivists want to do. So the issue for me at that point is not to try and set out criteria which will help theorists determine what is and what is not legitimate harm, to go back to an earlier point, but rather to analyze how harm seems to have been understood, controlled, regulated, if it was controlled or regulated, as far as individuals are concerned, in different systems of state. So the stress, in other words, is on historical sociology, but on a historical sociology which has at least some ethical anchoring, some moral foundations.
I've just got two more questions I'm going to take, and then we're going to have to stop. First of all, putting in the back.
Andrew, wouldn't you have to, in your historical sociology, raise the prospect that the modern state system might create more potentialities for harm, or not the state system itself, but economy, technology. Economy and technology, for example. I would think that would be a very important element in a sociology of harm, because it certainly seems to me that the modern state has capabilities to do harm, aside from the modern technology and the modern weapon, that was simply not available to pre-modern state systems or pre-modern political orders.
Yes, I agree with that, and that's why I made the point at one stage that this complicates the comparative exercise. Let's call it globalization for short, that does permit a rising level of cross-border or transnational harm, the level of which may be, I guess, is unprecedented in human history. Then the issue is, if we can try to make comparisons across historical time, what is the modern state system doing, not only to place constraints on cruelty in war, on violence, but what is the modern state system doing to protect individuals from the kinds of global forces, the development of which seems to be much greater now than ever in the past? That's very much why, towards the end of the discussion, I wanted to introduce the distinction between scope and depth.
I wanted to come back to your point about standards of legitimacy and the need for conventions against harm. I think I'm not
switched on.
Is it on? Yeah. Your point about standards of legitimacy, I think I'm not wrong. It was Robert Jackson who said that with the expansion of international society to Africa and Asia, one of the downsides, if you like, of that was that outside of the European state system, once international society expanded beyond Europe, it lost a shared cultural foundation, if you like, to inform the practice of state interaction. And the problem, perhaps now, and I don't know whether you would agree with this perspective, is that when you're trying to trace progress, normative progress in the international system on things like standards of legitimacy, the problem now is that key powers outside of Europe, particularly China and India, resist vigorously the perceived imposition of things like standards of legitimacy on the protection and promotion of human rights, and particularly you mentioned the situation of minorities. Your colleague from Kiel, Professor Thornberry, was lecturing on this earlier today at Chatham House, and a lot of the discussion centered around this very problem, that between North and South, there isn't this shared cultural perspective on standards of legitimacy. So if one is going to take this approach, a kind of expansionist or progressivist international society approach, how do you come to grips with that problem, that this North-South gap? And if anything, in recent years, this has been, you know, the gap isn't closing, it's widening.
The I bring in at this moment discourse ethics, and suggest, and this was one reason for my distinction between two sides to legitimacy, that one looks at the procedures by which harm conventions are decided. And the issue in connection with the post-European society of states, the multicultural society of states that that we live in, is just how far the harm conventions result from a dialogue which is fair to the world's different cultures. And I'd suggest that one measure of progress should focus on that. Who makes these harm conventions, with what purpose in mind, neglecting intentionally or unintentionally whose interests. So what is interesting then is not what the harm conventions in themselves are, or not just that, but rather, or perhaps preeminently, the justice of the conventions that create them.
Ladies and gentlemen, Martin White's outstanding characteristic, professional characteristic, I suppose, was this tremendous combination of historical range and philosophical depth. Very, very difficult to follow. In this Department of International Relations, LSE, we like to think that we have carried forward some of that concern for both history and philosophy in the years since his death. And at this point, may I give a small plug for the fact that the 75th anniversary of the department will start on January the 1st. And I can't say that we have a tremendous raft of exciting celebrations to mark the 75th anniversary, but we will have some important events, exhibitions of documents, and we hope to have a conference and a workshop later in 2002, and so on. Andrew Linklater, in giving this lecture tonight, has shown that he is not just a pure theorist, he is a very important theorist in modern international relations, but he has also got a great sensitivity to historical context and the need to range far and wide. And the idea of harm, which he's been talking to us about tonight, seems to me, he's convinced me, that it is one of those ideas that even if it has to be considered within the context of a theory of history and a theory of progress, that it's got more trans-historical scope as a way of measuring difference, if you like, and dealing with the problem of inclusion and exclusion and responsibility for others, cosmopolitanism, than some other classical ideas of political theory such as rights, democracy, and nation, which perhaps are more restricted by the particular historical context out of which they've emerged. So I found his lecture profound and interesting. It will stay with me for a long time, and I'm sure that that is true for you as well. Thank you so much.